So hello everybody, and thank you for joining us today at this online webinar hosted by the International Inequality Institute as part of the Migration, Ethnicity and Race Seminar Series. I'm Lucinda Platt from the Department of Social Policy at the LSE, and I'm going to be chairing the event today. I'm delighted to be introducing Sinyi Chung, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of Cardiff. And she's going to be talking about the violence of uncertainty, how asylum waiting time undermines refugee health. I'm going to hand over to her very shortly. I just want to alert you to the fact that today's seminar is part of the seminar series on migration and ethnicity and race. There will be a further seminar in this series coming up. The next III event to come up will be an event entitled The Effects of Cash Transfers on Formal Labour Markets, Evidence from Brazil, on Tuesday the 1st of December at 12:30. So, and I think there's information being put in the chat on that. And if you want to know more about events at the III, the International Inequalities Institute, then you can sign up to the newsletter and you can also see the link to that in the chat function. And now, without more ado, I'll hand over to Sinyi Chung. So thank you very much, Sinyi.
Thank you so much for inviting me and Lucinda and the III at the LSE. It's delightful to be having the privilege to speak about research in these very strange times, and also thank you for tuning in, because I know that everybody could be doing millions of things, and thank you for choosing to come and listen to this talk. So the title, as you can see on the slide, is The Violence of Uncertainty, How Asylum Waiting Time Undermines Refugee Health. And this is collaborative research with Professor Jenny Phillimore at University of Birmingham at the Institute for Research into Superdiversity. And so this is just an overview of the study in case I run out of time. I don't have time to. So this is the headlines. So the focus is on policies of uncertainty, which are aimed to inflict harm on individuals' health via detention, public degradation, and undermining access to health services. And I will say a little bit more about that as I go along. And asylum waiting time is a major factor in creating this violence of uncertainty. So our results show we are able to demonstrate a direct link between the longer asylum waiting time and poorer health status at the time that refugees were granted the status to remain in the UK, and a persistent effect almost 2 years later. And we also found that female refugees report high levels of health problems, both physical and emotional, and persistence over time. And tuning into the existing research, and it's been found that FAVE has a moderating impact on the effect, the negative effect on health outcomes. And we found only, it doesn't apply to all religions, it is only the asylum waiting time, the negative impact on health is only worse for non-Christians. So in other words, Christians are better off. So acknowledgement to, again, before I run out of time, I wish to thank all the asylum seekers, refugees who participated in the survey for new refugees between the time 2005 and 2007, which is when the survey was conducted by the Home Office commissioned. I think NESAN were the people who did the work at the time, and also for the UK Data Service for granting access to the survey. And this was a regional project, was funded by Nuffield Foundation. So thank you for their generous support. And just some very contextual background of the data. So how asylum applications look like throughout the 80s and into the 2020. So you can see that in asylum applications were highest around 2000, around the millennium, and this is 100,000 cases. So it was highest at the time of the Labour government, the new Labour government. And you can also see that in chart 2, this is Home Office immigration statistics, year ending June 2020, you can see that most of these asylum applications were actually ended up in refusal. Initial decisions were refused, and there are also other grants on other humanitarian grounds. So this is the kind of just a snapshot of the process, the final outcomes of asylum applications to the UK. And this was between 2012 to 2016. You can see that majority of the cases in the initial application were rejected, and then a proportion of them will go to appeal, and appeals determined. And so in the end, the overall grant asylum or other leave is about just over 55%. So again, this is analysis done by the Migration Observatory in Oxford, very helpfully summarized the trends over time from the early 1980s to almost 2018, showing that again, all the asylum, these are grants in a number of grants. Highest around the millennium. So claiming asylum in the UK, because the UK, we are a signatory of the UN Refugee Convention in 1951. So any well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, and a whole host of other conditions, including political opinion, such as those who don't agree with China in Hong Kong, is outside of the country of its nationality, or unable to return to the country for protection. So UK, we grant asylum, and we can't send them back to a country where there is a real risk of exposure to torture, inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment. So before 2003, they were called exceptional leave to remain or indefinite leave to remain. In 2004 onwards, however, things were tightened up by the New Labour government in a bid to be seen to manage migration and also deal with all the then so-called bogus asylum seekers. They were really economic migrants coming to sponge off our very generous welfare state, quote unquote. And they were granted these humanitarian protection or other discretionary leave to remain, often time limited between 3 to 5 years, and subject to review. So the list of countries of safe to return countries continue to grow by the Home Office. So even though we may think that it's not safe for it to send these compulsory repatriate these refugees or failed asylum seekers to send home, but according to the government, it was safe to send them home. So note the change to the language to discretionary. So increasingly, claiming asylum in the UK is getting much harder. Not only that, there was high rates of refusal. So the policy of uncertainty on health. Why do we call it as a policy of uncertainty? There's a lot of evidence, qualitative evidence or clinical evidence from across Europe and Australia suggesting a strong connection between policies of uncertainty in health. There are a number of reasons why. The inability to influence asylum process, the lack of control over one's life, concerned about the public perception, attitude towards asylum seekers, and very hostile reception, often leaving them feeling humiliated and lacking self-esteem. The fear of removal and insecure immigration status and being separated from family and not being able to support them. And most asylum seekers flee their country, not being able to pack or bring their children even. So they will enter another country before they start to think about bringing their family at a later stage. So this uncertainty and fear are said to have a great impact than pre-migration trauma. So there's resulting in a wide-ranging mental health problems, depression, anxiety, psychosocial distress, and suicide. So Grace et al, doctors, the medical doctors, they introduced in a 2018 paper, they introduced this concept of violent uncertainty in the New England Journal of Medicine, having witnessed the effects of state-sanctioned uncertainty on migrants in the US. So they found that deleterious effects on policy for some uncertainty on the health of individuals who lack secure immigration status have been observed across the global north, as I cited some of the research earlier. So violence uncertainty, what is it? It is a form of violence inflicted on refugees and asylum seekers and enacted through systematic personal, social and institutional instability that exacerbates inequalities and injects fear into the most basic of daily interaction. So there are two forms of harms, indirect and direct. Indirectly, it undermines trust in institutions, resulting in some of these groups being fearful of accessing healthcare and even reporting to any official authorities. And direct harm comes from the policy in impacting the individual's mental and physical health by undermining their security through a series of policies like detention, travel bans, and degradation with systematic insecurity and fear going beyond any one institution. So what is it like living in the UK while waiting for an asylum decision? So the living allowance was approximately £5 a day. It's just even to date in 2019, as late as now, it's about £37 a week allowance. And they used to call the National Support, National Association of Support of Asylum Seekers, National Asylum Seekers Support Accommodation on a no choice basis, so-called the so-called dispersal policy. Asylum seekers who chose to, they can choose to receive asylum accommodation or just support only. So they can choose to live with families and friends or self-serving if they have anyone who could provide them with a boat. But often if they don't have they don't know anyone in the UK, they are dispersed to various parts of the UK on a no-choice basis, and they could also be redispersed depending on the availability of housing in the locality. They were not permitted to work or study. So before 2002, asylum seekers waiting for more than 6 months for their decision can apply for permission to work. Now that all that had changed when New Labour brought in the Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Act, then removed the right to work. Again, that was all to do with that furore about bogus asylum seeker coming in to actually work rather than actually genuine fleeing any kind of natural disasters or political persecution. So from 2005 onwards, those waiting for more than 12 months can apply for permission to work, but that they have a bundle of restrictions since 2010. This is, you all know, that is when the coalition government came into power. They keep growing this long list of occupation or government shortage occupation list. They only permitted to work in those occupations that was in short supply, such as dealing with radioactive waste, or you're a world-class pianist or ballet dancer. So it's basically very, very hard to work. So life when receiving an asylum decision. So after the long wait, no matter how long you're waiting, what is it like when you receive the decision, so a positive decision? So now, in a whole host of assimilation research, length of residence is often, or time in the host country, is often associated with better integration outcomes. They build better social network, and their health improve over time, they can find work, access to education and training, etc. And also increasing institutional knowledge, and so they know where to find work and opportunities. Now that's not true for asylum seekers, because they couldn't work or study during the time when they were waiting for this decision. So what makes it worse is that they must, on the day they receive the refugee status or grant to remain in their country, abide limited period of time, they must vacate their NAS accommodation within 28 days. So they are effectively made institutional homeless. And also they are exceptional high risk of destitution because they can't find work. If you don't have an address, you often can't find work. They have no money to buy a suit or any smart clothes for interviews. They have very poor social network, especially those living in mass housing. So the impact on health is likely to be detrimental, but we don't know apart from qualitative research or some clinical data that doctors have. So we found this, the Home Office conducted a survey of all new refugees around the time 2005 to 2007. And it's the only refugee integration survey in the UK. And by and large, it's not terribly well used because it's not a survey that you have a comparison group with the general population. That's one of the biggest limitation. But also it has a very high attrition rate. So the fieldwork went on from 1st of December 2005 to middle of March in 2007. The questionnaires was posted to all new refugees age 18 and above who receive a positive decision. So they got their leave to remain in 10 different refugee languages. So the initial response rate was about 70%, not bad, with about just under 6,000 valid responses. But the attrition rate means that it, by way four, only under 1,000 cases remain in the survey. So it was ambitious, it was longitudinal, including four waves of data. At the baseline, it was within 1 week of the asylum decision, and plus three follow-ups after 8, 15, and 21 months, so almost 2 years after they first got the leave to remain in the country. So all the responses were weighted to represent the whole cohort who entered the UK at this time, in this time period. This was according to the report by the UK Border Agency. Now, the profile of these new refugees around the time of the survey, mostly very young, 70% under 35, and majority of them were men. The largest groups being Eritrean, Somalian, Iraq, and Iran. And they also come from different parts of Africa, the Middle East, and other Europe as well. Now, 31% spent less than 6 months in the UK before gaining refugee status. But also at the top end, one in five spent 2 to 5 years in the UK. And again, another 22% actually were in the UK for 5 years or more. So almost half of them actually held qualifications and were employed before arrival, many in professional or skilled trade occupations, and some with very good English ability, particularly those from the Commonwealth countries in Africa, like Zimbabwe. And generally, they have report poorer health compared to the UK population. We will see some figures later on. So how do we operationalize asylum waiting time? Now, obviously, we don't know, very few data set, survey or administrative data will actually be able to tell you how long refugee asylum seekers waited before they received the decision. Because the questionnaires were sent within a week after leave to remain was granted, the majority of asylum claims were made on arrival. Time spent living in the UK effectively captures the length of time waiting to obtain refugee status, i.e. the asylum waiting time. So 6 months was also the then Home Office target for processing asylum applications, recognizing the need to a speedy decision, not putting refugees or asylum seekers' lives on hold. They set themselves a target of 6 months to process all applications. But of course, we know that that's not true. And in fact, many asylum decisions took much longer. So this is another graph analysis done by the Migration Observatory. The share of asylum application within receiving an initial decisions within 6 months. So that's the Home Office target. So between 2012 to 2019, you can see the curve is drastically declined. So this is the initial decision. So that that also means that doesn't take into account of any appeals. So only one in four will get the decision within 6 months. So in the refugee survey, the SNR we call, it asks refugees on all four waves of data, four health questions using the short form health questions, short form eight health questions. So emotional health: during the past 4 weeks, how much have you been bothered by emotional problems, such as feeling worried, depressed, or stressed? So this is just a very quick table to show the, so overall, from wave one to wave four, So refugees, the proportion of refugees reporting better health actually does improve over time. See, those who reported feeling rather a lot, extremely worried, declined by wave four. So again, for physical health, it's much the same. Even fewer of them reported they couldn't do daily activities because of physical health problems. So, and this is a graph corresponding to the time they waited for asylum decision. So asylum waiting time, emotional health. So basically the longer, the trend is generally the longer they waited, the worse they reported very poor or poor health. This is for emotional, and that's the left-hand side panel is at the time of grant. And this is 21 months later. So lower proportion of them reported poor health. But this is the maximum effect capture at the time they received the grant by the length of time they were in the country. And this is physical health. And so a lot, the axis are exactly the same, the y-axis exactly the same, so that you can see very fewer refugees reported having physical health problems. So majority of them actually suffer from emotional or mental health problems. So moving quickly on to, sorry that I am straining your eyes here. I didn't have time to do all these nice charts and with confidence intervals and so here we go. But then of course, this is complete transparency. I'm giving you all the data and then findings, so you can see by yourself all the findings, so including the confidence intervals. So this is just controlling for a bunch of personal characteristics, including age, dependent children, whether they were living with a spouse, and pre-migration education. And this is just the parameters of logistic regressions of poor health at the time of grant on physical and physical and emotional health. So we can see that there are massive separate models for men and women. We can see quite significant negative impact on reporting poor health the further, the longer they wait. And the reference categories is, of course, using the Home Office target, less than 6 months. So these are on-time decision. So anyone, we could easily just lump all this together and increase the size of a sample to look at any not on time application and their health impact on refugees at the time of grant. So we also, following the literature, we also wanted to investigate whether religion or faith has a moderating effect on health post-settlement. So we see that comparing with the no religion group, which is very, very few, by the way, because about 48% of the survey respondents were Muslim and 40% were Christians. So only the Christians were reporting, less likely to report health problems at the time of grant. So that's the wave one. And so this is poor analysis, because we wanted to see a lot of literature suggests that women are more likely to report health problems, and we wanted to demonstrate that. So this is the pool analysis with men and women together. So we can see the positive coefficient of women shows that they are much more likely compared to men to have report poor emotional and physical health at wave one, and it remains the case for physical health at wave four. So these are just association, and again we see when the sample a bit bigger and pooled analysis, we see time taken to obtain refugee status actually had an enormous impact on the negative health effect. And again, we see that for parsimony, we group all the other religions together, and comparing non-Christian to Christians, we see Christians consistently come out faring better. Now, finally, I wanted to see whether the length of time waiting for asylum decisions actually is worse for women. So this is just a interaction term we put in for asylum waiting time and sex. So we see that it wasn't, there was no significant difference at the time of grants, but there was a significant impact, sex interaction effect on emotional health at wave four. So women do suffer more the longer they wait compared to men. So very quickly, I want to leave time for discussions because I'm dying to hear comments and from colleagues who taken the time to come and listen to this talk and see what you think. So we found basically something a lot of people have been speculating, but there is no evidence to show the link between asylum waiting time and this so-called fear or uncertainty, the violence of uncertainty. So no matter how much evidence there is from medical and qualitative research on the severe trauma and psychiatric problems of refugees post-settlement, there is no evidence of the direct link between asylum waiting time and negative health effect post-settlement. There is nothing until now. So the claim made in the New England Journal of Medicine of this connection between state policies of uncertainty and refugee health is empirically supported by our analysis. So our evidence shows the deleterious effect of the extended periods of uncertainty generated by lengthy and punitive asylum process in the UK. So what are the implications and where do we go from here? So our findings actually show cumulative violence and trauma that occurs across the refugee journey highlights an accumulation of inequalities and disadvantage over time and place, with gender being a key dimension of inequality. And many countries place both asylum processes and resettlement schemes on hold, and again, putting these people's life on hold, and housing them in an overcrowded makeshift accommodation environment as arrivals of asylum seekers continue unabated. So not to mention that now the Home Office, the Home Secretary's proposal of offshoring asylum seekers processing. So no matter how much the data have been 10, 15 years old, and the battle of integrating new refugees continues because nothing has changed very much, certainly in the UK. And we can see, given the state policy, the widespread use of policy of uncertainty in most developed countries, our work has much implication. Now, I want to end with a couple of methodological notes. So this study focuses on the association between asylum waiting time and the health of refugees post-settlement, so at grants of status and 2 years on. Now, obviously, we only rely on data of self-reported health on the short form 8 health questionnaire. We do not have any clinical data on health, unlike the medical doctors who publish in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we had a desk reject from NEJM, and not surprisingly, we're not medical doctors and we don't have clinical data. And also, in this particular paper, we're not focusing on improvement over time. And we actually, in a separate analysis, we ran fixed effect models on, we found by and large, language fluency is the best predictor of health improvement, but that we couldn't find any gender difference of improvement over time. Now, there are many longitudinal studies, contrary to expectation, refugee health do actually report improved health status, well-being post-settlement. And might be counterintuitive, but people do tend to report better health status over a period of time when they stay in survey. Now, obviously, with sample attrition, with any longitudinal surveys. So the question is, who stays in longitudinal studies or surveys? Are they tend to be healthier people who stay in surveys, healthier refugees? Are we overestimating or underestimating the health improvement or problems, even though we take a snapshot at wave four? So Patrick Hooksell and Tarani Chandola wrote a methodological note using multiple means to dealing of different ways of treating missingness using the SNR. And they show available case methods may underestimate health improvement of the refugees in the SNR. But they find no significant difference using missing at completely at random and multiple imputation and the use of survey weight approach. So our findings remain robust on the direct link between asylum waiting time and persistent negative impact on refugee health post-settlement. And these are just those of you might be interested in the different countries in the survey. And we can see these are the appendix of the Home Office report after the survey of real refugees were published. And these are the just appendixes. I thought you might be interested. So I'll end there. So I'll stop sharing screen now. We've got plenty of time for questions.
Thank you very much, Sunni. Well, that was a great introduction to your to research on this, and a speedy one too. So we do have lots of time for questions. So we can take the questions from people if you're raising your hands, or we can take them and I can read them out if you prefer to do it that way. But it'd be nice to have some in-person questions directly. We have Pierre Sen here who wants to ask a question, so go ahead.
Yes, hi, Professor Chung. Thanks for that fascinating talk. I just have a comment and a question. The comment is that I'm a psychiatrist by background. The comment is that certainly a lot of evidence from our literature is emerging that even after refugees have settled status, this is, you know, follow-up studies, that they do have much more mental health problems compared to the local population. So that's a comment, and that is, you know, becoming increasingly clear from the research. My question was, with regards to your data, was factors like immigration detention taken into account to see if that has an effect on the emotional health of the population? There is waiting time, of course, but waiting time compounded by factors like immigration detention and the experience of that, whether that has an effect on the emotional health of the population, whether that was taken into account.
Do I go on now? Unfortunately, we don't have data in the SNR to tell us that. So we don't know whether. Well, the only other thing, the only one thing I can think of is there were they did ask questions on whether they have been a victim of physical attack. Verbal attack. So they did ask the questions. I forgot which wave, so I could look into that, but not specifically whether they've been through a detention. So, whether they've been a victim of violent attack. So that whether it comes close, but not not completely. Well, yeah.
I mean, just to comment that the Royal College of Psychiatrists, we have a position statement on the effect of immigration detention on mental health. Mm. Which we are just updating, and that has been shown to be extremely negative for the mental health of this population. Thank you very much for that answer.
Thank you very much for your question.
Thank you. We have a question from Suzanne Wessendorf.
Oh, hello, Suzanne.
Hi, Cindy.
How are you?
Good,
thank you for coming.
Thanks for a really interesting talk, fascinating material. I was just wondering about the religion, you know, you said that Christians generally fared better. And I can imagine that in the survey, you might not have had any questions as to why that is the case, but do you know of any qualitative research that might explain why they fare better? Is it because of better support networks through churches or better access to civil society organizations facilitated via churches or things like that?
Yes, that I can check. In an earlier work between me and Jenny, we did actually have a much longer list of controls, independent variables, including access to social network and whether they get help from a range of organization, including faith organization, religious organizations. So the SNR actually, no matter how bad the attrition rate is, the richness of the questions are actually quite astounding. They ask questions on contact with friends and family, as well as there has been in our earlier work on economic integration and access to labor market, where access to jobs and also access to desirable jobs, the social network actually did make a difference. And but once we put in language fluency, it knocks everything out. So I think it's being able to speak the lingo in the country that you're living in and increases a lot of other issues, like you're more self-confident and you're likely to get jobs and also be able to communicate with your doctor is a big deal. In terms of not just religion per se, but also contact with religious organization, actually shown some positive impact on other outcomes like employment. I could go back and look. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Suzanne. So we now have Evelina. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Sinin, for the very interesting presentation. I actually had two questions. You just answered one of them about the role of employment, family life, and other factors that can provide structure and how they can improve health. My other question is related to the differences you have in terms of results, effects on mental and physical health. And I noticed that most of the coefficient was significant for mental health, but not for physical health. I was wondering if you could control for country of origin, or if you did control, and then maybe as a proxy for what kind of persecution refugees were fleeing for, whether it was war and physical harm, or whether it was say political persecution that might not directly cause harm, or they might not have been directly in a situation where they were physically hurt, and whether this might feed into their perception of their mental health. Say if they were fleeing war, they might feel physically safe now being in the UK but still being unwell. Thank you.
Yes, that's a great suggestion. We control for country of origin in the early analysis, nothing much came out, so we dropped it in the final models. And but of course, once you start collapsing the country of origins, you lose the details, the granularities. So either you have non-significant findings with smaller, larger group of smaller countries, and or you group them into continent, and then you lose details that way as well. So, and it is the problem with small surveys, particularly in the final wave, even with all the weights. I haven't actually checked with multiple imputation whether that is a really good suggestion. So we could go back and look. Thank you.
Thank you, Ethan. And we have a question in the Q&A. It's a question about, is it possible to request the source regarding policies of uncertainty being feared to have a greater impact than pre-migration trauma? I didn't quite catch it at the time. So could you repeat what the source was about uncertainty having a greater impact than pre-migration trauma?
That's the main source I'm citing in this paper or this talk is the New England Journal of Medicine work. The policy of uncertainty and fear, a state concerted coordinated effort to induce this prolonged period of uncertainty is it's not a fact, it's an interpretation. So we can, but we're operationalizing one of the major uncertainty of violence of uncertainty using asylum waiting time. And then a whole host of other policies of detention, putting them into overcrowded, very substandard accommodation, dispersal policy, far away from their own social network, friends and family. Those are collectively, we call it policies of uncertainty. And there's been other sources, other papers, and I can send references, and I can't actually put my finger on it at this minute. And then certainly commentators, medical doctors or qualitative researchers alike have been discussing, criticizing all these policies for a long time. But so far, we have been unable to actually put a finger on it, what it is actually and makes it so bad, and the length of time of wait, and not only that they're waiting, so it's against all sorts of, this is a long way of answering your question, so I will send the references and the sources. However, the length of time or time living in the host country has been coming up in our earlier work on employment and development of social network. The longer they stay in their country, the worse are some of the outcomes. We couldn't understand why, because it's just against all the intuitive assimilation, acculturation theories, because the longer you're in the country, the better you integrate it in the main. But this is completely the opposite. So we then suddenly click, actually, because the questionnaire was sent the week after they got leave to remain. So the effectively is actually the asylum waiting time. So the Home Office gave that one away quite unintentionally, but I think because of the SNR is just so underused, no one actually looked or bothered to look, because it's not a terribly good survey. If we're used to understanding society, all these very big, epic surveys. So it's not a survey that caught the eye of many researchers. So that's a we.
Can I clarify?
Yeah, sure.
So I think the hard question, the claim that the policies of uncertainty have a more detrimental than the pre-migration trauma. You're saying that's an inference rather than a measured fact or?
Right, yes, I will find that reference for you, yeah.
Great, thank you. There's another question in the chat from Liz Zace. She's saying she's recently chaired a commission on equality in mental health with the Centre for Mental Health. And she wondered if you found any greater impact on mental health of the different individual factors you mentioned, So being unable to work or housing poverty, which might suggest any specific policy changes which would improve mental health. So were there any particular policy levers you could draw out from your analysis?
Yes, I think allowing asylum seekers to work is one of the major policy driver to certainly allow them to. There are two, not only that the asylum policies, the processes is so convoluted and so punitive. And we have a very high rate of refusal and initial decision. And secondly, the wait is unnecessarily long. And during that time, they were subject to dispersal policy, so poor housing and not being able to work. And the worst thing is when they finally out of the woods, as it were, they have only 28 days to vacate the accommodation. So except in Scotland, I have to say that Scotland and Glasgow being the largest dispersal site in the UK, they have a different policy thanks to devolution. Refugees, once they got the refugee status, they are transitioned into social housing automatically. So they are not at risk of homelessness. So you can't find work. So the two policies, the clear policy action is to A, allow them to work. And so they can actually, is unnecessarily putting pressure on the state and people coming to sponge off our state, but they don't, they like to work, they are very capable of working, but they're not allowed to work. Secondly, provide support for families and friends to look out for their asylum seekers, relatives would be a good way to go, rather than putting, instead of dispersing them into economically deprived areas where they know no one, and also the local infrastructure. I think Suzanne's work is particularly on cities and infrastructures, on the warmth of the welcome of any particular localities, and not all the cities in rural England and Wales are geared up to welcoming refugees, and certain a lot of these infrastructure or welcoming infrastructure for asylum seekers and refugees are much better in urban areas and cities. So allow them to work, don't disperse them, are the two key policy action one couldn't come soon enough. It should happen 10 years ago and it's still not happening.
And can I just clarify, did that come through? Were you able to identify those in your analysis? Were you able to?
We can separate those in NAS accommodation and those who are not. And then often clearly there is an association between asylum seekers in national accommodation because they don't have families and friends in the UK, and therefore they have to go into NAS accommodation. So we can't actually say that because, and that's a direct effect of NAS accommodation, therefore they have a less developed social network, because it's a cause and chicken and egg issue. And they're primarily the Eritreans and Somalia. They're the largest groups, but they're also the groups that are the most recent arrivals at the time of the survey. But then they're not being able to work is universal for all asylum seekers.
Yeah, so you can't adjust.
Yeah, and then you have no money. If you're living on £5 a day, you have no money to go and buy clothes to go and look for a job, and the risk of homeless being homeless the minute you get leave to remain, and you think that your nightmare is over, but it's far from over now, as our evidence shows.
Great, thank you. So are there any others who would like to come in? Because otherwise I'll start asking questions. Do you have any others interested in putting their questions?
So one thing, there's something on in the chat.
So I've got a list of questions, but I'm not going to ask them all, or not now. One question was, you find this interesting difference for men and women, and the pattern looks like it's a much more linear effect for women, it seemed to me, from looking at your figures. So just longer time just makes things to decision makes things worse. But you didn't say much about why you thought there was that difference. So have you got any can you speculate, or have you got any?
Great. Thanks for the opportunity to deal with that. I didn't have time. Well, I did have time, but I neglected to add that. Yes, women are, as we saw in the descriptive statistics, only about a third of them. And I've done some comparative work with the Netherlands and their refugees, asylum seekers and refugees survey. They basically immigrant survey, and some of them are refugees and asylum seekers. The age and sex profile is very different in the Netherlands and compared to the UK. So primarily young men. And it's very unusual for women to seek asylum in their own right, because women often come in as a dependent and then join after the male, such as these 61% of men in this survey. They come first, and then after they got status to settle, they then bring their partner and children to come and join them. So who are these women who come on their own? And they are likely to be fleeing domestic violence, abuse, and some of them, and I didn't say earlier, although the majority of asylum claims are made at arrival, there are some who are very, very low number who are in-country application. So suddenly you're living with someone who you're subject of a domestic violence that you have to leave with or without your children. So you can apply for asylum. You can't go home and you can't actually, it's a form of physical torture or mental, and that includes monitoring your expenses, forbidding you to see friends and family, etc. So some of these women change status. So, and then lots of them, if they are living in the fear, not just fleeing political persecution, but also violence within the household, and they are likely to suffer a longer term emotional health problems. So that's one of them. And one of my PhD students, Laura, and she's doing a qualitative studies of refugee mothers, or what she called displaced mothers, forced migrants in Wales. And she found lots of stories among women. Some of them are in these cases, and they are very worried. Particularly worried because they see themselves having a caring role, and they are separated and what she called not just displaced motherhood but also fractured motherhood, because they couldn't bring their children. They are actually separated from their children's back, whatever country they come from, they're fleeing from, and they couldn't look after them, and they couldn't provide for them because they are living on £5 a day, and that created a huge an enormous amount of emotional stress and low self-esteem, and a lot of qualitative evidence actually supporting the and that's a really nice narrative for not for them, but for me, and then to put some flesh into the data, and that's why I started my talk and thanking these people who actually answered the survey, because every single case is a really horrendous stories behind their migrant, their refugee journey.
So thank you. Yes, so that's it's really interesting. But would that then explain how that relates to the fact that they also seem to not recover so much after settlement? Because you'd have thought that some of these issues would be resolved on being granted status.
Probably because they still couldn't get their family to come and join them, and they're unlikely to, if they have children. The proportion of refugees in the SNR living with children are primarily women, and they have to care for their children, and if they are evicted from their national accommodation, they have to find somewhere to live, find work, and support their children, and find education and training for the kids. And so there's a lot to take on. And of course, the one of the limitations of the SNR is not very long. And also, we decided not to look at data at 8 month and 15 month, because they went back quite quickly every eight months, six months, but there's not a lot going on in their lives. There's not enough action to capture because they are still, life is still pretty awful up to 2 years post-settlement. And I think the time for them to recover, if there's to anything, if they can recover, is taking, it will take much longer than just 2 years that we can observe. But yes, you're right. And once they got status, they have access to, they can work and they get access to universal credit. It was what, £370 if you're for a single claimant compared to £5 a day. So this just gives us the magnitude of scale, how badly we treat them.
Yeah, so there's a suggestion in the chat here that there's also the possibility that the long-term effect of severe and complex trauma on their brain may interfere with recovery.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I will find that reference.
So that's this is
the brain. Yeah. Wow.
Question. So that's an interesting additional possible explanation to bring in as well. So
I'm open to suggestions, and a lot of these I didn't elaborate very much about the why there was observed gender difference, and I have some qualitative data I can cite my PhD student, and a number of challenges and emotional trauma they women go through is probably explain some of the longer lasting emotional impact than compared to men.
Well, we're getting close to the end of time. I think that, is there anybody who wants to ask a quick final question? It's interesting. You've talked about strengths and weaknesses of the survey, but it's interesting that the Home Office did actually initiate the survey, even if the uses to which you're putting it are rather critical of the Home Office. So there's an interesting sort of issue there about making data available for whatever purpose.
Well, I was told that the Home Office, once they have done the survey, they didn't have any money to analyze it, so they just deposited it on the UK data service. So hopefully some poor academics will pick it up, and that was me. Yeah, and that's Jenny.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It was really interesting, and as I say, it's a very novel insight into refugees, about which we don't have typically don't have very much data, and so really good to sort of test some of those ideas out directly. Thanks very much all for coming. Thank you for all your interesting questions. Thank you very much, Cindy, for a very stimulating talk.
Thank you for having me.
Have a good afternoon, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucinda. And thank you for organizing it.